Hello and welcome to Real Bible Stories. Join us as we deep dive into the historic, religious, cultural, political, and emotional context surrounding the real lives of real people in the Bible and the stories we've all grown to love. Hello and welcome back to Real Bible Stories. I am your host, Imran Ward. I'm joined by my wife, Selena.
Hello.
And our teacher, Ryan Brown.
What's going on, everyone?
Well, I hope they're going well.
I do too.
All right.
Hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving and that.
Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and then Cyber Monday, and now here we are.
Well, you know what happened was that we did Thanksgiving. I went on a cruise for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, how was that? I actually didn't get to ask you how that went.
It was good. We didn't get sick.
That's always a plus.
You know what I mean?
For real.
Either COVID or food poisoning and or seasickness, so we were good.
Is it true that the cruise ships are so big that you can't even tell that it's moving? Like you don't get seasickness.
You do get. It almost feels like there's points where you're kind of like, oh, I know we're moving. You feel your equilibrium's off just a tad. Like it's not heavy, but it's enough to where
you're aware. Were there any storms or anything?
No. But no. So like we did the cruise, and then I got back. Let's see, Friday, I got a day. And then I had to leave for Orlando for a week for work.
All right.
So in the last like 2 weeks, I've spent all of 2 days at home. And I guess Thanksgiving and everything's just bled in together to me.
Did you guys take your family with you to Florida?
No, I'm not.
Oh, so you had your family for the cruise, but then you didn't have your family for
Orlando, no.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, I lose track where he is. I'm like, where's Ryan?
Yeah, because a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, you were in Hawaii. Oh my gosh, AirTags. That's a whole other thing.
But I hope everyone's doing good and had good holidays as we enter into the next.
Yeah. But all right. So for this week, we're going to be talking about the interrupted miracle, which is what I originally said that it should be called. And then going through it again. So Ryan actually like called us out because he said he had three titles for it when he originally taught this a few months ago. And he said that Selena and I agreed that the interrupted miracle was the best title for this Bible study. And then he came at us again with the same three ones, and we picked a different one. Yes. And then he got mad at us.
Which one did you choose?
The same one as you. We both had the interrupted miracle.
You both, when we were recording a podcast, I don't know, it was, months ago.
Months ago.
And I brought this up. I'm like, hey, I can't wait for the study. I don't know what to call it. I have all these good titles for it because there's so many themes here. One was the interrupted miracle. The other one was a tale of two daughters. And the third one was stealing a healing. And you're like, ooh, interrupted miracle. I've never heard that. You need interrupted miracle. And you're like, yeah, I agree. And then I just asked the same question again. And they're like, no, stealing a healing.
Stealing a healing has like, a nice ring to it.
Well, like, we're going through all three themes either way.
Yeah. Certified fresh. All right. I wonder what our podcast's Rotten Tomatoes score would be.
Yeah.
Hopefully over 75%. Oh gosh. All right. But to get into the lesson and study today, we're going to be coming from the book of Luke, talking about the interrupted miracle. So Selena, I'm going to hand it over to you to do the reading.
All right. So we're jumping straight into the reading, Ryan?
We are.
All right. So it's going to be Luke chapter 8, verses 40 through 56. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. And Jesus went. The people pressed around him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surrounds you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down from him before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened.
Thank you so much for reading that, Selena. Just from you going through the reading and hearing everything, I was like, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is going to be a long one. Oh, there's a lot of points here where I'm going to have questions. Oh no. So I hope you all are ready for this. I hope you take your Bibles out and you have your note-taking gear and you got your pencil and pen and you're ready to get after it. Before we hand it off to Ryan for his first point, just wanted to highlight our Facebook page. So if you look up Real Bible Stories, you'll come across our Facebook page there. It's got our same logo on it. Go ahead and like it, share it. If you got any comments, questions, or you want to just give us a shout out, please go ahead and write something on the post for the episode, and we'll engage with you. We'll respond, and if you got some questions, we'll look into it as best we can, and we'll give you the best answer we've got. But we hope to just continue to engage with you. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to Ryan to talk about our first point.
All right. So this is a very interesting story. There's a lot of underlining themes and associations that it's crafted really cool. This is one of my favorite narratives in Luke. And essentially, the situation is this. Jesus, who's kind of been, he's been around in ministry for a bit now. He has been making a name for himself. People have heard of him. He had just gone across the sea, and that's when he like calmed the storms and went over on the far side, cast out a demon-possessed man, came back from the sea, and he lands here. So, you know, a lot of things we don't really think about in terms of when some of these other events occur in Jesus' ministry, like when he calms the storm. Was he the only boat out in the storm?
Ooh.
Right? So the idea here is because he had been gone.
Actually, doesn't Paul like walk from one Peter. Boat? Sorry, Peter walk to him? Does he walk to him from another boat?
From their boat. So... But that's actually the different. That's a different story. This one is this one is when he's sleeping and there's a heavy storm comes in and his disciples are freaking out and Jesus wakes up and calms the sea, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about it is that most of up to this point, the healings that had occurred had not happened on that side of the sea. So word has spread across this town. He has not visited this town yet. Most of that had occurred, like in this previous narrative leading into it. So the question is, like, well, how did everybody kind of get to know about him because of how far disconnected he was? And a lot of it was like, well, yeah, there was more than probably one boat out at sea, you know, and then there's people were seeing these things occur and word is just spreading. Mm-hmm. So by the time he gets back into this town, there's a lot of excitement and a lot of buzz. And the text makes a point that there were so many people that It was practically like he was getting crushed. They were so close that he couldn't move. But within that, so he lands and a synagogue leader. So we're talking like a religious authority, right? Somebody synagogue means, so he was a Pharisee, you know, came forward and he said, "My daughter is dying." And he had all this faith in Christ and he fell at his feet, "Come heal my daughter." So they say, okay. So they start working, but the crowds were still there, right? They're still, pressing in on him. And then there's this other story embezzled within that intent, right? So he starts moving to go towards the house of Jairus to heal his daughter. But then you got this whole other narrative about this bleeding woman, right? So I call it the interrupted miracle because Jesus was on his way to do something and was interrupted. And there's this whole narrative, right? But I raise that because I want you to kind of think of the emotional context of Jairus. Because I have kind of like a similar, not like this, but but a scare like this where I could tell, I could certainly identify to Yairus's emotion as this is happening. My daughter, when she was born, her first night in the hospital, every time one of my children were born, you know, to help Trisha sleep and let her get rested. And, you know, honestly, just because I was excited also to have some bonding time with my own kids, I would always sleep with them. They would sleep on my chest. Well, she was a little squirmish, so she wasn't really having that and was getting real cranky. So I actually ended up putting her in the bassinet a little bit in the night. But we're sleeping, and I wake up just randomly about 1 a.m., and I look over in the bassinet, and I see my daughter's face is blue and purple, and she's struggling to breathe. And
oh, my goodness.
And she's choking. You know, so I'm going, I'm kind of patting on the back, and nothing's helping. So I start freaking out. So I pick her up, and what they had done.
How many years ago was this? Sorry.
Well, she's eight.
She's eight now, yeah, so about 8 years ago.
But so what they had done is when my wife had given birth, you stay there until you're, you know, discharged. And in this case, for whatever reason, the day after, like, you know, she was born, and then the day after that, they had 32 women come into the
like the NICU or something they call
not
it?
Not the NICU, but the just where you give babies. How am I forgetting the name right now? Where you go have babies.
I don't know. We haven't had a baby yet.
Anyway, that's true. Anyways,
I don't know any of this terminology.
Portion of the hospital, you go have babies. but like 32 women came in all to have babies. And it was like they got completely overwhelmed. So they ended up moving us down to this wing of the hospital to recover. But nobody was there. Mm-hmm. So my daughter's choking. I pick her up and I go running down this hallway. And it's like a scene from Stranger Things. And this is how I remember it.
Always just like getting longer.
It was just the hallway's long. It's dark. It's like every fourth light is on, but all the other ones are off. So it's just gloomy and just murder, like, you know?
You say murder.
But, you know, so I'm frantically running down this hallway, no one in sight. It's in the middle of the night, right?
Yeah.
And finally find a nurse, and she's like she could see that I'm like, she's like, can I help you? I'm like, I need help. And I showed her my daughter. Like, I couldn't even say the words. And she's like, this way. And, you know, she brings me over there and gets me in, and they're to take care of her. So I hand her off, and then they just take her in this back room, and she just goes back there. You know, I don't go with her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the problem is. I don't know, you know, like I waited there for about 30 minutes, you know, I'm like, did she die? You know, what is going on?
Yeah.
And in that time, one of the things I realized in moments like that, the only thing I could do within my human ability was pray. There was nothing I could do. The only thing I could do in that moment was pray. Mm-hmm. And often what you see here with Yairus, with his daughter who's dying, you know, she is dying. There is nothing he can do except for pray and bring it to Jesus. And that's what he does. He falls down at his feet and say, my daughter is dying. Like, there's nothing else for him to do. And I could identify with that. But other points to this narrative, though, that helped me associate with him is that another thing that I thought was true is that my daughter in that state, you know, if I would have gone into that dark, long Stranger Things hallway and, you know, there was, you know, 100 midget clowns, you know, wielding machetes, trying to stay in my way of getting her help.
Wow, that's very Florida 2018 of you.
Yeah, I would have.
Halloween.
I would have, you know, Heisman my way through every single one of them, right, to get her to help. It wasn't going to stop me, right? I would have done anything I could to get her to the help she needs, despite what's in my way.
Yeah.
Right? But I would also know, though, I mean, it only probably took 10, 15 seconds to run down the hallway to get her the help I needed, but it felt like forever. Mm-hmm. And I also would have realized that any delay, and there was kind of a delay. There was a delay when the nurse I found had got to the door to enter into that wing. She's like buzzing it. I'm just like, you know, I'm just there.
And like, it probably was only like 3 seconds.
Yeah, just buzzing it. And I'm just like, open the door, you know. Yeah. But any delay, though, any further delay could furthermore risk her life, right?
Yeah.
So here's Yairus with his daughter who's dying, totally helpless, falls down at the feet of Jesus, saying, I need help. Just like I was running down, found a nurse, I need help. And when they took her, she disappeared. There's nothing I could do except for pray, right? And this is essentially where Yairus is. But any delay to get, so Jesus says, I'm going to come with you. But then any delay at that point, though, to get Jesus from where he is to his daughter,
Is risking the life of that child.
Further endangers her life. And that is what his stress is, right? But then there is a delay. There's this big delay. And then not only is there a delay, but then there's a big spectacle with it, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk through it. There's a lot kind of going on here, but there's this duality between this woman and this dying girl that I think is interesting. So,
I do appreciate you sharing that, I wouldn't say tale, but that memory though, because it is interesting how our mind will just latch on to, like, you'll go weeks and only remember like one thing about that, but then you have such a significant event that like becomes like, you probably remember the color of the walls. Mm-hmm. Probably remember the, like, you could probably go and like map out that space and like draw it down.
The feeling, perfectly. The emotions, yeah. Let's kind of go through this a little bit of a, I don't want to say verse by verse, but I guess paragraph by paragraph.
Verse by verse, that was about 40 something verses.
We'll do paragraph by paragraph. But so it says now, when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at his feet. Right, we just talked about that. Pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. So notice how it mentions the age there. Mm-hmm. Because it also mentions, you'll see that number again here in a second. So a girl of about 12 was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. So see how the text says that it's really trying to show you not just the density of the crowd, but the intensity of the crowd. Right. And that feeds to both situations, right? One, the density and the intensity of the crowd is delaying Jesus from getting to Jairus's home. Mm-hmm. Right. So on Jairus's end, right, just like we said, you are delaying, you know, the ambulance essentially.
Yeah. It's like, get out of the highway. Get out of the street.
You are delaying getting my daughter the help that she needs. But it also plays into the bleeding woman. And we'll talk about it here in a second. But so the crowds were there, and the crowds almost crushed him. And then another woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for, again, 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. So right there, why 12, right? It's interesting because essentially, you know, we don't know precisely in terms of, like, did the bleeding of this woman start at the exact same, on the same day that this little girl was born. I mean, it
was just sometime within the 12 years.
But yeah, I mean, within that year though. So in the same year that this girl is born, this woman starts having bleeding. And this is like, the woman body is so odd to me.
Yes.
The fact that
the woman body
is
odd.
Very,
I wouldn't say to all women, but Selena tells me all the time. She's like, why is my body like this? Why don't you have to have a period? Why don't you have to,
I don't know,
like, have all these inconveniences? Why did you know that migraines is a primarily female issue? Like, vast majority of the migraines that happen, it's women that experience it. That's not actually something that
because they're 50, dealing 50. With men all day.
Yeah, maybe. But it's like, but migraines are like headaches, but so much, it's like, Selena was showing me some stats and articles on that. And I was like, oh my goodness. I did not know.
So I didn't know that either. This is a feminine problem that she's dealing with for 12 years. Right. So, but at the same year, right, both these problems that are all going to come to a head and they're going to intersect on the same day with Jesus, where 12-year-old girl who is now dying and then a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, right. They're going to intersect on the same day. But it's interesting, though, that he pairs that because, you know, numbers mean things, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, to you know, into Hebrews.
In scripture.
So, you know, we talk a lot about numbers. It's called gematria. And the number 12, and you see it a lot, right? If you think about it, how many tribes of Israel were there?
12.
There were the 12 that Jesus had called out. In the book of Revelation, you have... you're going to have 12,000 from 12 tribes. Like, there's always this 12. Well, what does it mm-hmm. mean? Across scripture, essentially what the number 12 annotates and represents and kind of should clue you in on is really three things. One is it represents the power of God, the authority of God, specifically how it's applied to like governance. So this is the way things are ruled. These are the ways things are governed. It's the way things are managed. So it's how things are controlled, managed, from the authority and power of God.
Right? That's interesting.
So that's kind of that. First off, that frames it, right? So we're learning something about how God manages and governs his power and authority within reality.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why when we talk about, you know, did this woman come steal a healing, you know, stealing a healing, right? Did she come steal the blessing that was meant for Jairus' daughter, who eventually dies, right?
Yeah.
In the story. And just keep that in mind, right? So that's kind of at the forefront of this. But so that was about Jairus, but let's talk about this woman for a second, right? So she's dealing with this feminine problem. If you remember, it's halakha, Jewish law. It's specifically referred as nadah, but it's ceremonial uncleanliness, right? So if you go to Leviticus 15, I think we've talked about it before, but Leviticus 15, a woman when she's on her period.
We have in different ways, yes.
Yeah. So a woman when she's on her period is ceremonially unclean.
Yeah.
There's like, you know, this is how in that time for women, like this is when there's a bunch of rules around that, right? And then you're unclean for a certain amount of time after that, right? We even talked about how actually intercourse for them due to this, actually you could only have intercourse within, there's like this week and a half window of the month kind of thing.
It sounds like, what's the cycle that we talk about when it's like the ideal time to have sex so that you have a kid?
Ovulation?
Is it the ovulation cycle?
Yeah, well, that's a cycle.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would be essentially like a week and a half within that cycle, which is just interesting.
It is interesting, right?
Yeah.
But the point, though, with this in this story, in the context of here, though, is that she's been bleeding for 12 years and won't stop.
Yeah.
And it says that nobody was able to heal her. No, there was nobody who was able to resolve this for her. So nonstop, she's been bleeding, which means she's been ceremonially unclean for 12 years. Okay.
Wow.
So that's one. But two, part of Nadah, though, just like the same reason why a leper would have to be kind of outcast from society, and they couldn't go touch because you would make them unclean. If you have leprosy and you touch somebody, you make them unclean, right? Mm-hmm. A woman with Nadah, the same was true. If she is unclean, then she is not able to touch anybody because she would make them unclean. And there's prescriptions for this. If you go read Leviticus 15, a woman who at this time of, you know, the month essentially, which for her never stopped.
Yeah.
But you would have to be refrained to your own bedroom. You couldn't share a bedroom with your husband because you'd make him unclean, right? You were refrained to your own bed. So here's a woman. We don't know if she was married or not.
Yeah.
But understand, for 12 years, the amount of loneliness she's dealing with, because even if she had children, it'd actually almost be worse. If she was married and had children, she's confined to a separate room. She can't touch her kids. She can't be around her kids. She can't touch her husband, be intimate with her husband, right? She is essentially kind of not, I don't want to say necessarily outcast, right? Like, she's not outcast from her family, but she can't.
It's almost like COVID isolation.
She's quarantined.
You're quarantined.
She's
like
quarantined for 12 years, right? So
I wanted to throw out too is that like the sheer weight of what she does then, because you talked earlier about the crowds being so big and so thick that they're pressing in, and then you have this woman who makes it all the way to Jesus to grab his cloth, which means that she has touched everybody.
Yeah,
and as soon as that confession, man, that's
it. Okay, so. Notice that the sense of the story is that when she touches the tallit of Jesus, the tallit is like the, so you got the kanaf, which is like your prayer shawl. And at the very end, you would have these tassels, right? So the tallit is the tassel, and she'd probably touch the tassel. That's also in terms of Old Testament, and they said that by his wings, people would be healed. Well, at the end where the tassels were attached on the kanaf were considered the wings. Okay. So like, for example, it's like when David says that, I find refuge under your wings, what he's actually referring to is the wings of the prayer shawl that you would cover yourself with when you prayed. So he says, in prayer, I take refuge is what David is poetically saying, because those were called the wings. That's where the tallits were.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that by his wings, you would be healed.
That's beautiful.
But the idea though, is that she came up from behind him. And touched the tallit, and then kind of snuck a bit back away into the crowd. We'll talk more about that in a second. I don't want to get too far ahead. But as it applies to here, like what you just said, though, right? So one, first question, if per Leviticus she is unclean, she's supposed to be quarantined, why is she out in public?
Yeah. And if it's been going on for so long, it's like people might, somebody, I mean, it depends how big this town is, but they may know who she is. And that as soon as they see her, they're like, you're not supposed to be out here.
You're not supposed to be here. So now you can understand why she kind of snuck in, right? Yeah. So the first obstacle is that, right? She is ceremonially unclean. The crowds are so dense that now to get to Jesus, she's touching people.
Yeah.
Again, so this is kind of like COVID in the sense that's like, particularly at the very beginning when we didn't really know a lot with this, but like,
this is the perfect time to have this podcast too, because we can all think back on, like, I had some awkward situations with my student. Just recently, one of my students had a terrible, terrible flu. And in the Marine Corps, when you're sick, you have to go to the hospital and you get something called a chit or piece of paper that says what's wrong with you and what the doctor says you need to do about it. And there's a particularly harsh chit called a SIQ chit, which means sick in quarters, which means you need to go to your home and stay in your home for X amount of days so that you don't essentially either spread whatever you have to someone else, or you don't, if you're injured, that you don't go out in PT and re-injure yourself or do something like that. So he was tested for a particular, it wasn't COVID, but it was a particularly aggressive strain of the flu. And he came into my office and handed me his chit, his SIQ chit. And he said, sir, I just wanted to make sure you had this paperwork before I went to SIQ. And I was like, to SIQ, get out of my office. Yeah. Get out of here and go home. What are you doing here? So don't get me sick.
It's essentially saying that you know and have tested positive for COVID and you show up into a big, dense crowd of people, but they all know you have COVID, right? So if you get caught, the shame, but not just the shame, because if you touch them, now they're ceremonially unclean.
Yeah.
Now you're putting an economic burden on them because now they have to go to Jerusalem
pay
and perform the purification rites or go through the purification process, give a sacrifice to get clean again.
Let's lean back to the episode from like 10, 15 episodes ago where we talked about kind of the daily economics of
the temple.
Not of the temple, of the individual like Hebrew man, because of how much they were being taxed by Rome, that they had to work every day. Right, and if they didn't work, then they didn't eat, because they usually only had enough money for today's food and maybe the next day's food. It's like, okay, you've now made this person ceremoniously, all these people potentially ceremoniously unclean, and the economic burden of now they can't work because they have to go do all this stuff. And it's,
but then have to go pay for the sacrifice.
Yeah, to become ritually
clean
again. They're
not in Jerusalem, so that means they have to make a trip to Jerusalem. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, very inconvenient for her being there.
I think this is more than inconvenience.
It would be, right, so she gets... So the fact that she's there is a problem, right? In terms of the crowd.
So
that's her first obstacle. How does she get to him if she's supposed to be in quarantine? She ignores it, right? The second obstacle is that she was in a weak condition. You bleed for, I mean, I've never bled like that for 12 years straight. I mean, I know, you know, when my wife, you know, has that every month, there's times for at least a time where she's always cranky. She's not happy.
Yeah,
right. Like
2022 is a better time. It's a better place to be.
So doing that for 12 years straight, you know, medically,
at least in America,
she's in a weaker condition. She's in a weak condition.
That's true. Like bloodletting like that.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
So not only is she trying not to be found, but she has to fight her way through a dense crowd that's so intense and dense that it's about to crush Jesus. She has to work and fight her way through in a weak condition to touch him, right? So that's her second obstacle that she is able. I mean, you see another example of this earlier in this chapter. If you go just back up in this chapter to verse 19, there's a story that the crowds were so dense around Jesus that his own mother and brothers and sisters couldn't reach him. Right, because of how dense that crowd is.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So she had, in her weak condition, the strength to go through. But the third obstacle she also had was that, which is kind of what we already talked about, but she had to do all this without getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just fighting through, right? But she had to do this without being caught. So that's kind of the situation, right? So here you have Jairus, Lord, come save my daughter. Okay, I'm coming. As he goes, there's this crowd, right? This dense crowd that's keeping him from getting there, right? And part of that crowd now is a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years in a weakened condition, ceremonially unclean, shouldn't be out, can't get caught, and fights her way through to touch Jesus, right? So then we have what we have, what we call would call the interruption, right? Mm-hmm. This is the interruption to the other miracle Jesus was on his way to do. And so in verse 45, it says that after she came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. Then verse 45 says, Jesus turns around and says, "Who touched me?" When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are all crowding and pressing against you." This is funny because the tone of this whole interaction right here, one, it's one of command voice, mm-hmm. right? Jesus is like, "Who just touched me?" Right? There's this big crowd, intensity, I'm sure loud. For them to hear this, for everybody to hear this, Jesus would have had to, you know, loud command voice, "Who just touched me?" Because Peter's response here is one of almost annoyance. "Master, the crowd is pressing against you. Like, everybody's touching you." That's like essentially saying when you're taking a shower, contemplating the drop of one bit of water that falls on you, right? Like, "So some water touched me. What drop just touched me?"
It's like, "Dog, you're in a lake."
You're taking a shower, right? but Peter almost has this tone of annoyance. Like, there's a lot of people crushing in. They're probably stressed. They don't probably like it. Maybe he was claustrophobic. I don't know. But they're going through, right? And then Jesus is like, "Hey, who just touched me?" He's like, "Are you kidding? Everyone's touching you."
Yeah.
What are you talking about, right?
The voice that comes to mind when I think of like Jesus saying that, "Who just touched me?" If you go back and if you have watched the movie Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, there's a point. There's a point where
you get along so good with my wife. My wife loves Harry Potter.
Great. I'm one that if I could watch it every year, I would. But that's like 10 hours of TV. 10 hours of TV. But there's a scene where Harry's name comes out of the Goblet of Fire, and Dumbledore catches it, and he opens up the sheet of paper, and Harry wasn't supposed to be in the Goblet of Fire, but someone put his name in. And he opens the sheet of paper, sees his name, and he just yells, "Harry Potter! Harry Potter!" And he just like yells his name out. And that's what I think of when we read that scene there. Jesus is like, "Who touched me? Who touched me?" And Peter's like, "What? Everyone's touching you."
Everyone's touching. Command, but like, "Who touched me?" Because then you also see this. It says, when they all denied it. This is what I think is hilarious. Everybody's touching him. Peter says, "Everybody's touching you." He's like, "Hey, who touched me?" And everyone's like, "I didn't touch you. No, I didn't." And it's almost like the crowd gets quiet, right? "I didn't touch. No, I didn't touch it. No, not me. Not everyone's. Everybody denied it. Who touched me?" Right? Verse 46, it says, "But then Jesus said, 'Someone touched me, because I know that the power has gone out from me.' Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed," okay, so notice that she realized, like, it's almost like she grabbed it. The bleeding stopped. She's like, and I'm sure she felt something. I mean, I don't know what the difference of feelings are. Selena, you could probably provide better context on that than I could. But somehow she knew immediately that it had been healed.
Selena gave like a nod. That was the funniest thing.
Yeah,
for
she's
me.
Just like, yeah.
She's like, "You can probably help explain this." Selena's like yeah, nods. Yeah. Says nothing.
But I'm not going to be talking about that.
It could be like a restoration of power that, like, if you feel weak, like, and then you're restored, it could be like a restoration of power or
strength.
Strength, yeah.
Like, so, wow, I have all this really energy.
Somehow she found, like, she knew, right?
Yeah.
But then that's when she's like, "Hey, who just touched me?" So now she's like, "Uh-oh," right? Like, like, dad just realized there's one less cookie in the cookie jar, right? And everybody denied it. And it's kind of like when she realized she couldn't go unnoticed anymore. Because at that point, what's happening is everybody's looking around, right? She shouldn't be out there. She was kind of like probably guiding into the crowd through the excitement that they were centered on Christ, but not her. Well, now the focus is not on Jesus. They're actually probably looking around the crowd of, "Hey, who touched him? Who touched him? Right?" And she's like, "I can't go unnoticed now. I'm caught." Right? Yeah. So then it says that she came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, right? So now all the people are there. She told why she had touched him and how she hadn't been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Now, what's interesting about this, one, you know, I said in the beginning, you could probably call this the tale of two daughters, because one, you have Jairus's daughter who is dying, who needs Jesus' help. But now you got this other woman who is needing Jesus' help, and that's his daughter.
Is this the only one? Isn't this a situation where this is the only woman that was referred to as daughter by Jesus in the Bible?
No.
There were other points?
Yeah.
Someone was telling me that before. This is the only time he used the word daughter.
I'd have to look into it. I don't know. I haven't really ever explored that. It would surprise me if this would be the only case, but it's not. Maybe. I don't know.
No, I want to Google it again.
Yeah, I have to Google it. Yeah. Well, anyways, so... But notice, though, that when Jairus comes to her or comes to Jesus, where does he come to? Jairus comes and falls down at the feet of Jesus, pleading with Jesus, right? You notice that in the very beginning. Synagogue leader falls down at his feet. Come heal my daughter. The woman who's trying to get healed. And of course, Jesus, you know, obliges and he's on his way. This woman quietly, discreetly sneaks in behind him, touches his tallit. And sinks right back a win, and he felt it, right? The power has left me. And when realizing she could not go unnoticed, then she comes in front of all the people, falls down at his feet, and is now where Jairus was. You notice that? See how they both came to him two different ways? One tried to sneak it, the other one in the very beginning fell down at his feet. So why did Jesus not just let her go? Right, he felt the power leave. He knew it had happened. He knew that she knew where the power came from. But why did he make such a debacle of this? Particularly why he's on his way to do another healing that in our context would be very time sensitive, right? Mm-hmm. Why did he make her come up front?
That's a good point, because when he heals the other daughter, he's more like, don't let it be known. But here he's making like a public
spectacle of it.
Yeah. That's actually
interesting, because he said don't let it be known, but he literally just did another miracle like just before that.
Where he made a big spectacle of it.
That's hilarious. Mm. Okay.
So why, and not just that, but of what it's about, right? Like it's kind of embarrassing, right? Like but she's like pleading at his feet. I've been bleeding for 12 years and nobody could heal me. I am unclean. I shouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. I put all of them at risk and I've made them all unclean. And I'm just this awful, awful, awful person. Really embarrassing. And almost, you could almost at first glance think that he's trying to shame her. And I think that's part of what she's scared. That's why she came up trembling. It said, you notice how it said, and trembling, she came at the feet of Jesus.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Cause she's like, I messed up.
He's hollered out, who touched me?
Right.
Sure.
He knew she got caught. Now she's afraid because she's like, I stole the healing. And now it's in front of everybody. I'm embarrassed. That's shameful. You know, like this is a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. So why do you guys think he brought her out? Because it wasn't to embarrass her.
Well, this is a perfect transition to the answer to the earlier question too. So I can answer both of them with this. So on BibleReference.com, if you trust or don't trust that site, you do whatever you want. BibleRef.com. They say first Jesus calls her daughter. She is the only person in the New Testament to be called daughter by Jesus. Moments before.
Okay. Yeah. That's a cool fact. Okay.
Moments before, a respected synagogue leader has prostrated himself before Jesus, begging him to save his deathly ill daughter. This woman apparently has no champion to speak for her. So Jesus stops what he is doing and takes the time to make sure she realizes that he is her champion. He will claim her as his own.
So that's probably a good summary of what I had broken out.
We'll still break it out.
But yeah, I like that take though. Like that's a good take. So I don't know. Well, Selena, do you have anything before I got into mine? So no. Okay. Well, the first thing I had wrote down was one, he didn't want her to have a second class healing. So whenever Jesus would heal somebody, it was a personal thing. Often it refers to when he does a healing, the Bible makes it clear he takes them away from everybody. He takes them away and he has this one-on-one with them and he heals them. You see that a lot with the blind, with the deaf, that he takes them to a quiet place and it's one-on-one and he heals them. Mm-hmm. Here she was healed, but there was no one-on-one with him. There was no interaction with him.
No engagement.
There was no engagement, and it wasn't a publicly known thing, right? So she's essentially getting this second-class healing than what everybody. Now Jairus comes up. He's down in front of Jesus. He's pleading with him. Jesus is able to engage with him, sees his faith, says, let's go. Let's go save your daughter, right? This woman had the faith, but it wasn't public, right? Which we'll get into a little more in a second. But the second thing I wrote is I also wrote that he did not want her to misunderstand the source of her healing. See, for her, she came up and touched the tallit, was healed and walked away. So when she gets made out, there's a lot of it that's probably like, it's almost like it's just like this supercharged little tassel, but there's only so much power in it, right?
Yeah.
And it's almost like what people, that modern nonsense of crystals and,
you know,
let me go charge and energize my crystals for my home.
Like, you know how people like pray to the saints in the Catholic Church sometimes? Or not sometimes, it's like a thing they do. I just popped in my head, it was like people praying to Jesus's tassel. It's like, oh, I just pray for the power that's in your tassel.
You know what's funny?
To heal me.
No, me and my wife were watching this documentary. Actually, I think it was last night, but it was about the Ark of the Covenant and where they think it might be. And I had always known that there's this strong Ethiopian tradition that they possess it. And they're just kind of doing this breakdown of, you know, well, is it really there? You know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But there's this huge tradition around it to where the Ethiopian church has like these little mock-ups part of ceremonially of the Ark of the Covenant, and they march it out and all the people are there essentially kind of praising it. And I was like, it's how ridiculous this is, because particularly what the Ark of the Covenant represented was the mercy seat where God sat and dwelled. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking about probably in our next one, actually, how the slab, within the tomb of Christ itself acted as a mercy seat and how that's depicted in the imagery in John. That's for next week. But the idea is that this is where God dwells, right? Mm-hmm. We all possess, God dwells in us. In other words, we are far more holy than the Ark of the Covenant is now, but yet that which is more holy is fixated on this object, this inanimate object that was a signpost for what it, besides the point, I don't want to chase that rabbit.
I get it. That was a perfect expansion of my brain's thought of,
yeah,
what if people worship Jesus's tassel? And it's like,
but there's
like, then you have people worshiping the Ark of the Covenant and not God himself. It's like they're worshiping the Ark.
She did, because it does say that in his wings, there would be from the power of his wings. And so she probably thought the power was in the tallit, right? But the power wasn't in the tallit. It actually tells us, where did the power come from, right? There's two things that healed her. What does Jesus say? Did you guys catch it?
It was her faith and him, I think.
Yeah, his power healed her, because he said, the power has left me.
That's fair, yeah.
Right, so in order to get healed, you need Jesus's power. But that's not what Jesus tells her. What does Jesus say?
Your faith has made you well.
Your faith has healed you, right? So two things there. That tells us about a relationship now, doesn't it? In order to be healed, in order to be healed, you need the power of Christ, right? And the faith in Christ. So it's not just that God, that what you have faith in needs to have the power, but whatever possesses that power, you need to have the faith in, right? In mm-hmm. other words, if I could say this, some people have faith in things to save them or heal them, but whatever they're having their faith in doesn't have the power to. And then on the inverse of that, Jesus has the power to heal and save many people from many situations, but they don't have the faith in him to do so, right? It's a relationship between the two. You need Jesus's power paired with your faith in that power to make you well. But he did not want her. So one reason I think he brings her out. So first reason, I don't want to cheapen this healing for you. Because everybody else I have healed, I've been able to look in the eyes, face to face. I wanted you to see me and me to see you when I did this.
And it's like, you need to understand this exchange and how it just went down.
Right. I'm not going to cheapen your healing experience, right? The second one, though, is you also need to not misunderstand where the power came from. Mm-hmm. The power left me, not my tassel. It left me, and it was in your faith in that power that saved you. Had nothing to do with the tassel itself. Right, it had nothing to do with the tassel. But the third thing I would say is I think he wanted her to be free of the guilt of essentially stealing the healing. Mm-hmm. Right? Because she came in, she made a bunch of people unclean. She's out there now. They're like, oh yeah, she should be quarantined and she's not. Great. Did she touch me? I don't know. How did she, oh gross, what do we do? Right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, I'm not, are we all unclean and don't know it? And like, but you know, now she's feeling bad. She's probably embarrassed and shamed.
Probably terrified too.
Oh yeah, and how they're gonna act, right?
Yeah.
But that's why you don't you notice, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Mm-hmm. Go in peace. You can be at peace with this. You do not need to carry any guilt for what you just did. What you did was an extraordinary act of faith. I know the law said that you were supposed to stay. Nada said you were supposed to stay quarantined in your home, but you had enough faith in me to travel out, risk social, what would you call that? Social criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Fight your way through the crowd to come to get me. And all you said is that you could touch me. That is faith. Right? Your faith, the faith that drove you to do that, that is what saved you. Because if you didn't have the faith in me that I could really do that, to risk all that, right? You could maybe have had a little faith, but not that much faith. He's like, the immense amount of your faith to drive you to be able to do that, that saved you. Don't feel guilty at all. Go in peace, right?
I think that there's also a note, I don't know if you're going to bring it up here, but I think he also saved her, or protected her from the reaction of the people as well. Because if he hadn't brought her out in this public display and claimed her as daughter, and then said what she did was good, and then said what she did was right, then, and did that publicly in front of everyone, then the crowd there, which has been put in an awkward position where they may be ceremoniously unclean, they may have to pay this fine, they may not be able to work, they might be extraordinarily angry. So you have an angry group of people, that mob mentality comes out. She was at risk of potentially either being harmed or being killed through that harm. And so, Jesus kind of protected her essentially by making this public declaration that this what she did was not wrong.
So I don't want to cheapen what Jesus is doing by making this like association, but I think it very much is though kind of what it was like. You know how like you see a celebrity, right? Or a K-pop band going through and everyone's going crazy going through and everybody wants to get the autograph, get the picture, touch you, you know what I mean? Like as mm-hmm. those kind of celebrities are going through, it's kind of, I think, like that with Christ in a sense, that as he goes through these crowds, it's not just that they're like there to watch him. They're asking him for things. Everybody's asking him. Everyone's trying to touch him. Everybody. Right. Notice that everybody was touching him. She was healed. A lot of the reasons they were probably touching him is because they had things in their own life they were probably trying to get resolved through the touching of him. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman was able to. Right. So she was probably in keeping with what most of the crowd was doing, which is trying to touch him to get something from him. Right. But I also think, and this is the most important point to me. So I like the take that Jairus' daughter, and we were going to talk a little bit more about the advocacy piece here in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like to take though that here he is providing the advocate for her, but I don't think that's the primary. The primary to me, the most, I think the reason he brought her front and center was because he wanted everybody to know that her faith was known. Her faith had healed her, but it had not been made known. Jairus fell at the feet of Jesus. He made his faith known in front of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My daughter is dying. Come heal her, right? Displaying his faith in the power and the authority of Jesus, right?
Yeah.
Now remember the number 12, right? How Jesus, the power and authority of God, governs things, right? So he shows his faith in it, but it was made publicly known to everybody. Here mm-hmm. is this woman who had the faith, but it was not publicly known, right? And he brings her front and center, I think, primarily to make sure her faith was known to everybody else. And that kind of leads into, I think, the fact that faith is not intended to be a private matter. Mm. You know, there are many people, I think, who have strong faith in Christ, and you know, they study and they're faithful, and that they live even good, faithful, obedient lives to the teachings of Christ, but they don't make it known to people. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a public thing for them. Or they don't worship or walk publicly in faith with other people in the same faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the idea, though, is that our faith is not intended to be private. That was something that started really coming out of the patristic era with the Greeks, where they started to individualize the faith. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior, right? Like, yes, it is a personal thing. You personally have to accept him, right? Mm-hmm. You personally have to make that decision. No one can make that decision for you, but it doesn't stay there. The personal decision is one of also assuming you're coming into a community, a family of faith, right? The whole construct of the first century church, all the controversies about the Gentiles coming in with the Jews was one, are we accepting them into our family? What mm-hmm. is the metric to which we accept them into our family?
Mm-hmm.
So it was always meant to be public. We're supposed to have baptism is meant to be public. You were saying, I am identifying with this family, right? So it's not meant to be a private matter.
Yeah.
You know, and people treat it that way. It's almost like they treat it like
culturally, they try well, yeah, and push like, it in that direction.
Ask somebody
to keep your
faith. Who they voted for, right? Or about their faith. And it's like, oh, those things are private. You know, I have a personal relationship. Okay. But do you have a public relationship with Christ?
Yeah. Do you have a personal relationship with who you voted for? But
yeah,
you definitely should have a public relationship with Christ.
Do you have a communal relationship yeah. with him? Are you going and walking life with other people? Are you sharing this faith with, are you making your faith known, publicly known? Are you letting yeah. people know this very embarrassing thing about this woman, right? I've been lady issues for 12 years nonstop. Now she's front and center of everybody. Really exposed, very vulnerable, scared to death. She's trembling.
Confessing to
but sharing her faith.
Yep.
And Jesus lifts her up and says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Everybody, you see it? Her faith has made her well. Go in peace, right? So it's meant to be public, but we're not done because all the while, he's still on his way to Jairus' daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
While Jesus was still speaking. So here's the delay. Let's jump back to Jairus now, right? Jairus, daughter, dying, yeah. come help me. Crowd's keeping him. This woman touches, who touched me? Now he brings this woman out front, and now there's this big spectacle with this woman. All the while, Jairus is probably there in the back, just, you know, pacing.
Hey, man.
Let's go, right? Yeah. My daughter is dying.
Clock's ticking.
So then he had this whole intercourse with your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Great. And then Jesus begins to preach, right? So now... So now you have Jesus preaching.
No.
And it says, so while he's still speaking,
yeah.
Jairus is probably freaking out, right? I would be.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm not trying to make light of that because I've been in that situation of, like I said, any delay is a stress, right? So it says, now while Jesus was still speaking.
That guy's in
speaking,
the back just doing burpees, just like, hey.
Right. Mm. But he's your help, so you can't be like, come on, you know?
Yeah.
So while he was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, he said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. So the worst fear of Jairus in this whole situation has come true.
What a slap in the face. Like, that would be to, because if I remember correctly, so he's a Gentile, he's not a Jew. So he's already kind of going outside of his cultural norms to go ask this Jewish teacher for help. Like, so he's at his wit's end. He's at his, it's like, this is my last chance to do anything because I'm willing to do anything for my daughter.
And Jesus
agreed. And he gets to Jesus.
And Jesus agreed.
He gets to ask him to help. Jesus agrees to help. And they're working their way back. And then this derails that walk. And then you get that slap in the face of, it's too late.
Your worst fear. Right. Everything that anxiety of the urgency, the time of the essence, the disciples seem to have the same urgency with Jesus. Hey, come on. Everybody's touching you. What are you talking about? We got to go. Right. She's dying and the crowds are intense. Right. And Jesus, right. Because they still don't fully understand who he is yet. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at this time though, so now Jesus is there, like now he's preaching and I say it that way. Because I identify with how Jairus was probably feeling, right?
And at the time, I can only imagine he must have been like, he must have just cried out, like to get that news after doing all that work, reaching that point, and being so close to this is like the hope that must have been mm-hmm. in him in that moment, and to have it just like this dashed away,
taken away, and for the moment, it seems like. the interruption of the bleeding woman has now seemed to cost Jairus his life. All right, so now think about the bleeding woman making everybody unclean, shouldn't have been out in the first place, sneaks in behind Jesus, touches the talit, didn't come humbly at the front like he did. Eventually he gets her out. Now he brings her out in front, right? And now there's this whole spectacle, and now he's preaching because of it. In his mind, he's probably like, his mind's completely distracted. I wonder if they're like, he has ADD or he is like preaching ADD, right? Like they got him distracted on something else now. Like, remember me, right? And remember me. And you didn't remember me. Now my daughter's dead, right? And remember, we're talking about the power and the authority that governs how God governs reality. Right, so we're talking about the governance of how does God dish out blessing and healings and miracles, and there seems to be this competition. Jairus was there first. This woman interrupts, but in the interruption of the woman, now his daughter's dead. She stole it, right? So now, you know, the governance of how God dishes these blessings out is based off of, you know,
capitalism, competition.
Yeah, free for all, like just, you know, go at it. So for the time,
free market blessings.
Right. But then hearing, so then they come, he gets the worst news of his life, and it says, now hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe and she will be healed. So the thing is that even to them who had seen all and heard of all these miracles Jesus was doing, yes, he can heal the sick and he can heal the blind and he can heal the bleeding woman and he can do all these things, but he can't raise the dead.
Because he hasn't done it yet. That's his first instance.
Right. That's like death is such a strong hold on things that you can't raise the dead. So don't bother him anymore. But you hear the despair of Jairus, your daughter died. You don't need to bother with the teacher anymore. Hope is dead. Mm. Hope is dead. Jesus hears it and says, hey, just believe. Just keep believing. She's going to be fine, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what he does. He continues to believe. So they keep continuing on to Jairus' home where the girl had died. When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except for Peter, John, and James. That's his inner circle. We've talked about them. Mm-hmm. James and John, sons of Zebedee, and Peter, his inner circle. So he takes his inner circle of the 12 in with him, and the child's father and the mother. So the only people who are about to witness what happens here is James, John, Peter, and the daughter's parents, okay?
Oh, before we dive into this, something that I was just reading here that just stuck out to me is that when Jesus finds out the daughter is dead, he doesn't say, don't worry, I'm going to bring her back to life. Don't worry, I'm going to, she'll be alive. He says, and this is NIV, right? Or ESV, it says she will be made well, and in your text it says she'll be healed, which is interesting because we associate a lot of finality to death. Like you have to be brought back to life, like through some means, and there's a finality to it. But Jesus seems like he's looking at more as like another type of sickness. It's like, oh, we're gonna heal her from we're gonna heal her from that death.
Well, he actually, here in a second, refers to it as she's not dead, but gone asleep. She's fallen asleep. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Do you guys remember where else we saw that? Remember when we did the week on grieving words from a grieving God?
The Lazarus one?
Lazarus, and it says, you know, he's fine. You know, he's fallen asleep. Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. They're like, well, he's sick. He should be sleeping. The sleeping's good. And he's like, okay, let me spare this out. He's dead. Lazarus is dead.
He died several days ago.
But to him, his perspective, she's not dead.
Yeah,
she's fallen asleep.
It's just interesting that Jesus doesn't see death as a final thing. He doesn't refer to it as a final thing. He refers to it as, I'll make her well. I'll heal her. She's just sleeping. Lazarus is just sleeping. He doesn't associate finality to death. And I never really noticed that till just now. And that's incredibly interesting.
So we're getting into the Christmas season. And I remember this from last year. So my kids are all sneaky. I know they are. So Christmas time's around. They see Amazon packages coming in. They know when mom and dad do the trip down to Palm Springs, right? So they know when...
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they know when Christmas presents are coming when in. Christmas and they just can't... And you start seeing them like, what are you doing in that closet? I'm looking for the scissors. I'm like, why are you looking for the scissors? Get out of there. You're not going to find the presents, right? So what I started to do is I take the presents and I lock them up in my shed. I have a little lock and, you know...
Mm-hmm. Now they're going to hear this podcast episode.
Them, that's where your presents are. You stay out of it. But I'm here.
Yeah.
So my son comes running around. He's like, Daddy, lock the shed. I'm like, yeah, because I don't want you getting your presents. He's like, but my bike's in there and then you locked it and my presents are in there, Mom. And I'm like, son, to him, there was a finality, right?
Yeah.
To him, it's over. I walked the shed. The shed's locked and he can't get his bike now. There's a lock on it. Because his presents are in there, he can't go in and get his bike. Mm-hmm. It's over. He gets no bike, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, son, I have the key. I'll get you your bike. You know what I mean? Like, I'll get you the bike. Mm-hmm. I possess the key. And with Christ, it's like, look, it's like we look at death like at the shed, right? Like we look at the shed of life and we say, the door's been shut, the lock's on, we're dead. He's like, hey, everybody, just... I got the key to life. I have the key to life.
Stop freaking out.
Right. I have the key to it. Right. So.
Yeah. Anyways. It's just something that.
But there's a big piece here at the end here. I don't want us to miss.
Yeah.
In verse 52, it says, meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her, the little girl. Stop wailing, Jesus said. She is not dead, but she is asleep. So in the Gospel of Mark, actually, in his account, it actually says it wasn't. He calls it like a commotion. There's like this big commotion. Within and outside the house of this girl, and Jesus goes in and actually sends them all outside. So he kicks them out of the house. Mm-hmm. So here Luke says he brought John, James, Peter, and the parents in with him, but he also kicked people out. We learned that from Mark's account. So he kicks everybody out, only brings a select few in, okay? And then verse 53 here, they laughed at him. The idea of one is like they're wailing, they're mourning, and then he's like—
Rightfully so.
Right. And they're like, he's like, stop wailing, stop crying. She's not dead. She's just fallen asleep. And they're just like, what we don't know what a dead person looks like. And they laughed at him. It was a very cynical kind of tone. They're laughing at him, knowing that she was dead. Mm-hmm. But he took her by the hand and said, my child, get up. Her spirit returned. And at once she stood up. So, let me keep reading. So then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. So notice there's kind of two odd commands here, okay, how this piece of the story ends, okay? Odd command number one, and I found this interesting, give her something to eat. Mm-hmm. So he just healed this bleeding woman of a 12-year affliction.
Mm-hmm.
This little girl died. He brings her back to life. Right, he resuscitates her back to life, but he couldn't do that with a full belly. You know, like, but then there's a direct command. There's a direct command: give her something to eat. And you know, there's a direct correlation between resurrection and food. If you ever notice, after every resurrection, there's always food. Jesus is always eating. After he resurrects, he's always eating. There's something about resurrection that makes you really hungry. I'm sure there's probably a really cool medical. Like explanation for that, like, well, yeah, if this is why you'd be hungry, right? I don't know what that is. I'm just saying biblically,
as
always talks about eating right after resurrection.
As Pastor Dave would say, when we get to heaven, we can look at the tape.
Yeah, there you go.
Look, pull out the VHS for those that know what that is.
But I think one important element, I think the one reason it's included though, is because it's making the point that she came back to life and give her something to eat. I think Luke wants, there's a couple things going on here, but one, I think Luke is trying to make it clear that this was a physical resurrection. She's not a ghost. She's not a spirit. That this isn't some spiritualized resurrection. This is a physical bodily resurrection that requires food, right? To replenish her energy. But
that's really interesting.
I think a deeper spiritual point with this though, again, to the point you can resurrect her from the dead, but you can't resurrect her with a full belly of sustenance and food, right? She's hungry. He tells mom and dad, go make her a sandwich. Why? And I think this is an interesting element that is important for people to know. God does not do for people what people can do for themselves.
Interesting.
See, we God created us to purpose. He says, there are things that I know you can do. You're created to a purpose. There's things you can, within your element to do, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to do for you what you can do for yourself. When God performs miracles and he intervenes miraculously, it's when he is doing something that you can't do.
Yeah, he's otherwise would not have been able right. to do.
So when he intervenes, he is intervening in something that you cannot do yourself. That's the whole crux of the gospel. I am dead in my sin. A dead person can't resurrect themselves, mm-hmm. right? The whole reason we need a savior is because I can't save myself. I cannot do for myself what God can only do. If I could save myself, there was a way for me to save myself. Christ wouldn't have come and died on the cross, yeah. right? God only does for people what they cannot do for themselves. And I think that's interesting mm-hmm. because, you know, if you look at Jairus, right? Jairus cannot heal his sick daughter. He couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. The bleeding woman, it says that many doctors tried to heal her and they couldn't do it, right? She couldn't do it herself. They could not do that for themselves. So all they can do with it, the only thing that was in their human capacity to do was take it to Jesus. Take it to prayer.
Takes us back just to like your story in the beginning.
Right. Just like when my daughter, I handed them over, she goes into that black hole behind that wall and I have no idea what's going on. The only thing within my human ability, I could do nothing for her. The only thing I could do now is pray and give it to God, right? The same thing is true of here where there's nothing he could do. He gave it to Jesus. He says, I'm going to do for you what you cannot do. But here's the thing. She resurrects, but you can make her a sandwich. So go make her a sandwich. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's important because maybe the reason some people are not seeing the miracle in their life that they're asking for is because there is something in that situation, whatever it may be, but maybe because there's something there that a miracle is not needed.
Yeah. It's like what you're asking for is not so miraculous. You could definitely do it.
Right. You're just unwilling to do what God tells you to do.
And unwilling to do the work.
If I can maybe put it this way, God acts miraculously for people when it's something they can't do. But if it's something they can do, what he then offers is leadership. That's why we have the Spirit. The Spirit comes in to lead and guide us in the things we can do. And then he intervenes on our behalf. Again, the advocacy piece.
Mm-hmm.
He intervenes on our behalf on the things that we cannot do. That's where the miracles come from, right? So people are like, oh, just I'm praying for that miracle. And it's just not happening. Well, probably because there's something God is telling you to do that you're refusing to do. Because is it that you can't do it or you're just being lazy?
Yeah.
Right? Like you don't want to actually work for the healing. This kind of goes back to, remember when we did the, I think we titled it Position or People, the story with the man by the healing above the pool. And Jesus asked him,
exactly.
Are you willing to do the things necessary to be healed? And that's mm-hmm. essentially what the question he asked. He says, our English says, are you willing to be healed? But what it really plays out is, are you willing to do the things necessary to be healed?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, it's not the problem is that I'm not willing. The problem is I'm unable. Right? And what does Jesus do?
I am willing to help you.
I am able to help you. I will help you. And he heals him. Another miracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the man was unable to do it.
Yeah.
He was willing, but unable. There are some people who they are able, but unwilling, right? So here, like, I think it's just important for people, right? Look at, if you're praying for that miracle and the miracle is not coming, there's probably somewhere in your life where God is providing leadership on, but you're not submitting to, you're not hearing. Because maybe you haven't really taken this to God like Jairus had and like the bleeding woman had ask for the leadership, right?
I want to also throw out there that this is not a slight on those that that are asking for those things and are praying for those things. If you have not cried out to God and spoken to him on a regular basis, you may not be familiar with the sound of his voice. And I mean that quite literally in some ways, that the way Jesus and God present themselves and the Holy Spirit presents themselves in your life to give you that leadership and point you in that direction, quite often we'll find our human tendencies get in the way of that. And we just choose not to see or choose not to pursue the thing we're being led to pursue. So as you're crying out and getting angry that your miracle hasn't been granted or that whatever you're looking for hasn't been answered, maybe take a step back and really see, okay, is there something that the Holy Spirit is leading me towards? because maybe that is what you need to take action on that is actually going to ultimately solve your problem. Because quite often, God does not solve your problems the way you want him to solve your problems. He solves your problems in a way that's going to make you a better Christ follower. So
well, just something also, to think about. I could say two follow-on points with that, right? So one, if Jesus would have made it to her on time, by on time, I mean by on time to as per Jairus's time.
Convenient for Jairus.
On Jairus's time, right? He would have healed the girl and she would have, and he would have been blessed, right? He would have worshiped Jesus and it would have been a, still probably a story in our Bible, right? But how much more greater is the blessing to have your daughter resurrected by him? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's something pretty incredible, right? So what seemed like a tragedy to him initially, this other woman here interrupted my miracle and it cost my daughter her life, and the tragedy and the emotion that was probably there with him and all the people who were there who were wailing. And then Jesus shows up and says he does something even more incredible, right? They had a more fuller and deeper and impactful experience of Christ's power than they otherwise would have.
Yeah.
Would have been good, but it wasn't that good, right? So, so sometimes, you know, maybe you don't expect the blessing you want on your time because what God actually has planned for you is actually much better, right? The blessing that you're going to receive is actually much better than what you were. You're like, hey, Lord, just send enough money to, you know, to pay my bills this month. I'm behind. I'm stressed. You know, all. And then he says, oh, I'm going to wait a little bit, but when I come through, it's going to be even better than what you thought, right? It's going to be incredible. But yeah, so that's one. But two, I guess I could say this: when he heals the bleeding woman, he says, the power has left me, so Christ's power, and he says, your faith has healed you. They all had power or faith in his power, right?
Yeah.
For some, we have faith in God's power to perform miracles, but we do not have faith in his leadership to guide us.
Ooh,
you see what I'm saying? So having
that's one.
Not just faith of his power, but faith in his leadership.
Yep. There we go.
And you see people, man, I've been struggling with pornography and I can't just break it. I can't break it. I'm just waiting. You know, God has, the miracle has to come through. God has to intervene to break. Well, what do you expect him to do? Right? Like, what do you expect him to do?
Yeah.
Make you unattracted to women? Right? Like, what do you mean? What miracle, right? Because it's fully within your power to be able to get that under control. But there's actions and steps you have to take to get it under control. Follow the leadership
you have to make
of
in
the
work
spirit
you,
of how to do that, right?
Yep.
Find somebody you trust who could be accountability to you and et cetera, right? So not just having faith in the power and authority of God, but in the leadership of God. But then lastly, the last odd command, notice with the bleeding woman, she steals, you know, quote unquote, stealing the healing, right? But she sneaks the healing, right? He says, no, get back over here, front and center, right? Makes it a very public
posture
spectacle.
Yourself.
Right, very public spectacle and gets her right there in the front. So everybody can be known. So her faith is known. Now here, he shows up, people are wailing. He says, don't wail, she's not dead. She's just fallen asleep, and they laugh at him. Mm-hmm. Kicks everybody out of the house, brings in his inner circle, the parents, raises her from the dead, go make her a sandwich, right? Odd command number one, odd command number two, but don't tell anyone. Don't tell anybody what happened here. Well, you just had this bleeding woman in front of the entire crowds, and now here, you're telling them to tell nobody. Mm-hmm. Why? Right? Why?
Yeah, I don't know. That's
it's strange because it obviously made it to the Bible, so...
Well, the inner circle was there.
Because here's the thing.
Like, but now everyone knows.
Well, here's the thing, though, is these people are wailing because they love this little girl, or they love the parents. They had associations, right? It's not like after this girl was raised from the dead, they were never going to see her again.
People would have known she was sick.
They knew she was dead.
Oh, yeah, there were enough people that knew she was dead.
Yeah, they were wailing, and he says, she's not dead, she's just fallen asleep. And they laughed and said... pretty much just saying, look, we know what dead means, right? They laughed at him knowing that she was dead. That's what the text says. They laughed at him knowing she was dead. They knew she was dead.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden,
she's not dead.
A day later, you see her out there on the little...
On the swing set,
just, you know, like, hold on next second. what happened? And they go to Jairus and they say, what happened with your daughter? We knew she died. Mm-hmm. And what is their response now going to be back to those people? Jesus told me not to tell you.
Yep.
Think about that. Why? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's
true. Your faith needs to be public to everybody. This miracle, though, is for you all. Don't make it public to them. And the reason why is because, and this is just maybe a personal opinion, mm-hmm. Because that conversation, right? Wait, she's running around. What happened? Jesus told me not to tell you. They knew what happened. She's back to life, but what exactly happened? Still not to tell you. I can't share that with you. Why not? Because he said that, right? He's coming in. They're laughing at him. They had zero faith in his authority and power, right? That he would be able to do and raise her from the dead. And because of that lack of faith, it cost them, you know, to witness a miracle and be included in it. Their unbelief kept them from experiencing that. So if I could just wrap this up with just a couple things. One overarching thought, remember the very beginning, 12 years old.
Yep.
The 12 years, this is, we're talking about the power and authority as it's applied to governance, right? So how does God govern and apply his authority and power to people in the kingdom? See, the fact is he told her, you don't need to feel guilty. Go in peace. You didn't steal anything. It was given to you because of your faith. Yeah. But my grace is endless. Just because you took that power does not mean now that I don't have the power to heal Jairus's daughter, right? So how does he dish out his authority and his power as in terms of governance of things? It's by faith, not by limitation, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like this big overarching, it's kind of bracketed within that. So the big five takeaways, right? Number one, I would say healing requires God's power and our faith. It's our faith in God's power that heals us, but also our faith in God's power can also heal others, as it was the case with Jairus. It was by Jairus's faith that saved his daughter. It was by the bleeding woman's faith that saved herself, but it was Jairus's faith that saved someone else, saved his daughter, right? So our faith and how we bring that is to your point of advocacy, right?
Yeah.
You act as advocates for people, so pray for people. Be praying for people.
Mm-hmm.
You're not in that. You may not be in a bad situation, but I guarantee you, there's people you know who are.
Jordan Peterson had doing a discussion on despair and depression and stuff like that. But he said, like, even if you are not currently in a state of despair and depression, that feeling is pervasive enough that everyone knows at least one person who is going through that. Right? There is someone that you need to give attention to and pray for in your life, or you're the one going through it. It is pervasive enough.
And if you're going through it, right, your prayer or your family's going through it, your prayer time is probably very much focused on that situation, and that's okay. If you're not going through that, then are you providing the same bandwidth and advocacy in terms of faith and prayer for others?
Yeah.
Right, like, hey, Lord, I'm going good. I'm not in a storm right now, but my coworker is. And you commit the same prayer time to them, right? Because you bear advocacy for them. The second thing, though, is faith is a public matter, not a private matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Definitely.
So don't forget that. Your faith is public. It's not a private thing. If you've been living a very private type of life, and let me just throw this last thing. I think a lot of the reason people like to keep faith private because they would almost be embarrassed to make it public.
Yeah, but that usually means there's something in their life they need to work on. It's like, people know that I have like three mistresses, blah, blah, blah. So if I told them I was a Christian, like, that would call this into question. People know that I have a gambling problem. People know that I have a drug addiction. People know that I have a porn addiction or something like that, or I have a foul mouth. So if I then profess that, you know, Christ is Lord and I worship him and all that,
and
you turn around
and
you start cussing, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, exactly.
They're immediately convicted by the Spirit because they know that's embarrassing.
Which is something that the Spirit is trying to tell you that you need to.
Right, exactly.
You have stuff to work on.
Exactly, right.
So you can be my good and faithful servant.
Much of the reason it's like, well, if I were to make my faith public, that'd be very embarrassing and almost shameful to the honor of Christ. Well, then fix it.
Yeah, it's like, right? It's like, you're right. Now do something
exactly
about
right.
it.
Right, then fix it.
It's like a sense of accountability too. It's like, now that it's publicly known, then it's like, aren't you a Christian?
Yeah, it's like why we have weddings. Like weddings, when you have a private wedding, like just between you and the judge, and that's it. No one really knows that you just got married. Like that's not fully in the spirit of what marriage should be. When you have that big public display, bringing two families together, there's a declaration of that this person is mine forever. Like now everyone knows that this just happened. So now you have accountability from the community that
you have witnesses. Is the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if years later you're seeing them like you got divorced, well, we saw you make your commitment and the vows you took. So what so egregious happened that forced you to get out of that covenant? Yeah. Right. And if you're like, you know, we just grew apart and,
it's like, oh yeah. So what was the point of all the, all the stuff you said, all the pomp and circumstances?
So,
pomp and circumstance. Sorry.
Number three, God withholds blessing because sometimes his intended blessing exceeds what we originally asked for. But not just that though. For those who disbelieve, right? Your lack of faith, what does that cost you? Right? If you're kind of shallow, you know, or no faith at all, but what does the lack of faith cost you? So that means not only do you not receive those blessings, but you don't even get to witness them in others, right? Just like this crowd did at the end. Number four, God's grace is infinite. The woman, quote unquote, stealing the healing from Jesus did not rob Jairus of his blessing, right? It may have seemed that way, but that wasn't the reality. The way God governs his power and authority to those he loves is equal. It's infinite. It has nothing to do with his ability and his power and his authority. It has to do with our faith in that power, that authority, as we talked about, that leadership. Yeah. And then the last thing I would say this, which is, I'm going to say this a different way than what we've talked about, but ultimately, faith produces hope. Hope does not produce faith. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Faith is what produces hope. Your hope is not what produces faith. In other words, there are some people who I hope it's true, therefore I'm going to have faith in it. I really hope there's a God. I hope Jesus resurrected. And because of my hope, I'm going to have faith in it. That's not the way that works. The way that works, it's in your faith, which is what produces hope. It's actually in my faith in Christ. And the more I learn in my faith in what he said and taught and the promises he made, that now anchors my hope for the future, right? So here you got Jairus.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to throw Hebrews 11, 1 through 3, which just is, let scripture interpret scripture, right? So what's Brian just said is straight out of the Bible. Hebrews 11, 1 through 3. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the convictions of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their condemnation. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible.
Right. Because to the point of like the story we, you know, here in Luke is that Jairus had faith in Jesus. And that faith gave him hope for his daughter. Mm. She dies, and I think a lot of his hope died with that. But then when Jesus says, hey, just believe, have more faith. In other words, what he's telling them is have more faith, because if you have more faith, you'll have more hope.
Mm-hmm.
And he does, because they still go to the house. So he maintained this faith, which increased his hope, and he went in and he was satisfied in it, right? Now, if it was the reverse, if Jairus had hoped Jesus could do it, then he was going to derive his faith out of the hope. I hope you can heal my daughter.
I don't really have faith that you can actually do it, but I hope that you can. Man, imagine.
Right. And then the second she dies, he's like, well, deuces, I don't have faith now. Right. Mm-hmm. But hope is an outworking of faith. Faith is not an outworking of hope. And I think that's important for people to kind of think about, where's your hope anchored? Where's your faith anchored? Which one is dependent on what?
Yeah. Right? They make it conditional. They're like, well, my faith, trust, and belief in Christ is based wholly within the blessings he doles out on me. So as soon as my life starts going poorly, or as soon as things are going the way that I want them to go, well, clearly there is no God. Clearly there is no, there's no Jesus that saved me because X, Y, and Z, I'm going through this in my life. And it's like, nope, that's not the order of things. That's not how this is meant to play out. Like, life is not going to be easy. There is nothing in the Bible that guarantees that your life is going to be easy. it actually will take work to grow you in your faith, to grow you in your life. And we should be pointing each day towards being a better Christ follower and trying to get to a more perfect state.
So, well, we, all three of us, have a Christmas Carol concert to go to.
Oh, yeah. So about that time.
We're going to leave it there.
Yeah. Yeah.
After going through this whole study again, I take it back. Let's keep the uninterrupted miracle.
The interrupted miracle. Okay.
First choice.
All right.
Oh, I love it. All right. So thank you so much for tuning in this week to Real Bible Stories. Brian, this was a really great one. And I don't think it's too complicated, but it definitely has some of those hard pills to swallow. So I really appreciate the discussion, and I hope that everything made sense. If you got any questions, comments, concerns, please check out our Facebook page. If you want to come talk to us in person and you're in the cold right now, not that sunny, not that hot, very cold in 29 Palms, California right now, but come and check us out. We'd love to hang out with you. If you're in the 29 Palms area, we've got a Christmas concert or Christmas service, Christmas Day service, Christmas Eve service that they've got planned out. So a candlelight service on Christmas Eve. So if you'd like to join us in worship as we get closer to Christmas, please come out and hang out. So thank you so much for tuning into Real Bible Stories, and we will see you again next week.
Thank you for tuning in to Real Bible Stories. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to leave a review, share, and subscribe to be notified each week when we upload new episodes. Real Bible Stories is produced in partnership with Palms Church in 29 Palms, California. If you would like more information or want to check out archived sermons and Bible studies, please check out the church website at palmsbaptistchurch.com or check them out on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. Real Bible Stories can be found wherever possible.